Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. As many of our listeners know, the Voice of America broadcasts Talking History internationally. But perhaps its even greater claim to fame is that the VOA is one of the largest and most powerful communications networks in the world, with a fascinating history of its own. This is the subject of our conversation this week with Alan Heil, the author of a new book on the history of the VOA. And after that, Talking History regular Thomas Fleming returns to offer some historical insight into the course of events that has led our southern neighbor, Haiti, to its current deplorable condition. He titles his commentary, The Making of an Historical Nightmare. But before we get to those subjects, Dan Roberts joins us for another moment in time, this one focusing on Eva Perón.
Of all the political choices available to future Argentine dictator Juan Perón, probably the best choice he made was to choose Eva Duarte as his wife.
A Moment in Time with Dan Roberts.
Eva Duarte was born around 1919 and grew up with her large number of brothers and sisters in her mother's boarding house. Just shy of 16, she escaped her small town and came to the city of Buenos Aires. Eva had little education and no one to whom she could turn, but she was intelligent, grittily determined, ruthless, and very beautiful, with a naturally blonde head of hair and a terrific figure. Appropriately, Eva settled on a career as an actress, and although she never quite attained star status, she did appear in several mediocre films. Her acting ability might best be described as determined. She also worked as a radio actor, and there gained a modest following during the early 1940s. It was during this time that rumors began to circulate that she was a very sophisticated and popular prostitute. Whether or not these rumors were true, it is clear that sometime before 1945, she became the mistress of Juan Perón, an ambitious middle-level army officer. She became his confidant and assisted in his political ascent. After Perón's inauguration as president, his wife further organized the labor union movement, distributed huge amounts of public money and political patronage, and established a vast network of vital contacts throughout the country. She was probably more popular than her husband. When she died in 1952, tens of thousands of mourners filed past her casket. Tributes to Evita were played on the radio for days. At the University of Richmond, this is Dan Roberts.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, according to a new book by Chris Roberts, Heavy Words Lightly Thrown, Britain's most popular nursery rhymes are teeming with references to bed-hopping royals and teenage sex. Roberts, a librarian at East London University, reports, by way of example, that Jack and Jill may have been fetching water, but it's really about losing one's virginity. Goosey, Goosey Gander, Where Do You Wander? May well be about the struggle between Henry VIII and the Catholic Church. And Ring a Ring of Roses could be a reference to the rash displayed by sufferers of the Great Plague. Some of these popular rhymes date to the Middle Ages, but most trace their origins to the 1500s and 1600s, may have been intended for adults, only to be written up and illustrated for children in the 1800s by the Victorians. By then, Roberts concludes, their original meanings were lost. This is Talking History. The Voice of America is the nation's largest publicly funded broadcasting network, reaching more than 90 million people worldwide in over 40 languages. Our guest this week, Alan Heil, Jr., has written its history. It's a remarkable story of transformation from a fledgling shortwave propaganda organ to a global multimedia giant encompassing some 1,500 affiliated radio and television stations around the world. Welcome, Alan.
Delighted to be here, Brian.
Alan, Walter Cronkite has described, or maybe I should say praised, your book as being the inside story of the Voice of America. So maybe we ought to start with your telling our listeners a bit about your work with the VOA.
Well, I joined VOA as a news writer trainee in 1962, and I had held many posts throughout the network. until my retirement as deputy director in 1998. But I would say that among the most rewarding assignments were that as Middle East correspondent from 1965 to 71 and director of news and current affairs from 1973 until 1982.
You were truly an insider.
I guess you might say that. Someone once said that I did everything at The Voice at one time or another except broadcast in Chinese.
All right. Well, I'm sure you would have gotten to that with a few more years, but maybe that sets us up for really the lingering opinion here, the question that we ought to get out right at the start. Is generally people still sort of see The Voice of America as an instrument of American propaganda? And in your book, you don't dodge the question. In fact, you lend some credence to this in the early years of the VOA, but talk to that point for us a bit.
Well, you know, propaganda has been a loaded term in the U.S. popular mind ever since the Nazi regime made it infamous in World War II, and that was when VOA was created. Governments traditionally have propagated their views via mass media or via personal contacts and educational exchanges. But one could even say that the Declaration of Independence was the first American propaganda document, obviously aimed at European audiences, including those in the mother country, Britain. The drafter of the Declaration, Thomas Jefferson, wrote, "Let facts be submitted to a candid world." And the founders pledged in that document as well to have what they called a decent respect for the opinions of mankind. Now, these are sound principles for credible international broadcasting today. And the constant struggle to get the news straight, whatever the pressures from our own or other governments, persists to this day. In international broadcasting, credibility is everything. I suppose the signal event in The Voice's history in creating accurate, reliable news and other programs was the passage of its charter into law in 1976. That charter says that VOA news will be accurate, objective, and comprehensive. It hangs on virtually every wall in every office of the Voice of America offices today. And it's regarded not only as a shield, but as an obligation to get it right and get it straight.
All right, let me take you back to the beginning, and there's so much in this book, we can't deal with it all, but let's deal with some of the highlights or major periods. If you go back to the 40s when it began, tell us about its founding, and was it a propaganda operation at that point?
Well, at its founding, of course, was, as I said, during World War II, and that was on the morning of February 25th, 1942, that it first went on the air with its German broadcast. And pioneer broadcaster William Harlan Hale said, "The news may be good for us, the news may be bad, but we shall tell you the truth." Well, at that time, 79 days after Pearl Harbor, the news was mostly bad. But The Voice was part of the Office of War Information, and its purpose was to help win the war. So there were the inevitable battles between the policy officers and the journalists. But the bedrock principles held. At the end of the war, there was a rush to demobilize. The Office of War Information was shut down. There were doubts then about whether The Voice should continue to exist. For a time in 1946 and early 1947, it looked as if it would be shut down altogether. But then in 1947, Senator Alexander Smith of New Jersey and Representative Carl Mundt of South Dakota headed a congressional mission to Western Europe. They discovered that Radio Moscow was pervasive and that tiny Netherlands had a larger overseas information program than the United States. And so the future of VOA was then assured.
So it continued on, but during the 50s and even in the 60s, it faced some serious challenges. Maybe you can tell us what those challenges were and how it responded.
Well, indeed, it was placed in the Department of State after the war ended, and it took a few years in that setting. In the early 50s, however, The Voice was confronted with another severe crisis and challenge to its credibility, Senator Joseph McCarthy accused the State Department of harboring communist sympathizers. He fastened on the voice as a target. He held hearings to interrogate selected managers and broadcasters, so-called informers as well as those accused. No charge that McCarthy made was ever proven, but the damage to the voice took years to overcome. Its global construction of transmitters was halted for nearly a decade. In 1953, legislation was enacted reorganizing the U.S. Overseas Information and Cultural Program, and the voice was placed within a brand new independent body, the U.S. Information Agency. The voice rebounded in the late 50s and promulgated at that time its managers. The VOA charter mentioned earlier as a statement of principles which stand to this day. But in the 1960s, a succession of events, the Bay of Pigs fiasco, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Vietnam War, and the Civil Rights Revolution in the U.S., tested the voice and its credibility as never before. And under the Johnson administration, senior officials leaned hard on the voice to compromise its reportage on Indochina. Sometimes they were successful, often they were not.
You mentioned two other events that you feel were crucial. You just mentioned some in the 60s. At the end of the 60s, you mentioned the year 1969 and the U.S. lunar landing, and then later you mentioned 1989, of course, and the collapse of the Soviet Union. Why were these challenges to VOA?
Well, I think they were both challenges and opportunities and demonstrations of VOA's effectiveness. When Neil Armstrong planted his boot on the lunar soil, VOA had what was likely the largest radio audience in history. 450 million listeners was the estimate. The BBC World Service switched to the voice for an announcer's description of that epical event. In 1989, the voice again was present for the dismantling of the Berlin Wall, and it tracked closely the fall of the communist governments in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, and Romania in the following weeks. VOA already had covered the inauguration of a non-communist solidarity government in Poland earlier in 1989, and the inauguration of that government ironically occurred only a day or so after the Tiananmen massacre in China. You see, at that time, the contagion of democracy was spreading like wildfire in the world, just as it had been in America and Europe precisely two centuries earlier in 1789.
One large theme throughout the book is this whole idea of struggling for independence. And you conclude your history with a very interesting chapter, essentially on that same point, as if to wrap it up, the struggle to get it straight, independence at the new millennium. It's my impression of VOA is sort of overcome this, but is there still an issue there?
Well, in 1999, the U.S. Information Agency became a casualty of the end of the Cold War. USIA was folded back into the Department of State, but VOA and the other U.S. non-military broadcast networks, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Radio Free Asia, and Radio and TV Marti to Cuba, were placed under a new oversight body, the Broadcasting Board of Governors. The board prided itself with being independent at last of the U.S. foreign affairs community. It is bipartisan, consisting of 5 Republicans and 5 Democrats nominated by the President and approved by the Senate. The 9th board member is the Secretary of State. So the chairman, one of the other board members, is always from the political party which holds the White House. A structure independent of policymakers had in fact long been a dream of VOA journalists and other broadcasters who felt that news judgments should be guided by the traditional Western journalistic norms of accuracy and objectivity.
Let me move away from this idea of objectivity for a moment and take up another subject here, because I think many of our listeners probably only encounter VOA through its radio broadcast, and I know we've made a major transition from shortwave to high-tech radio, but VOA has even gone into sort of a multimedia arena at this point. Tell us about that. How is the VOA involved in more than radio?
Well, that's certainly true for the first 4 decades of its history. VOA had reached most of its listeners via shortwave, But beginning in the late 1980s, a profound revolution, the multimedia age, as you say, was suddenly upon us. It was necessary to reach out via the standard broadcast band, or medium wave. Then came the FM revolution, particularly in the newly freed countries of Eastern Europe and in Africa. In that continent, as a matter of fact, in 1990 there were two independent FM stations. That number grew to well more than 100 by the end of the century. Well, satellites and digital technology made it possible to reach overseas radio stations, which are called affiliates of the Voice of America, instantaneously. I think there are more than 1,000 affiliated radio and television stations to VOA today, and more people were turning to TV or the Internet for information, particularly after the fall of repressive regimes not only in Eastern Europe but in Asia, Africa, and Latin America as well. So within a decade, VOA and its oversight agencies suddenly had to reckon with huge technological as well as geopolitical changes. It had to get resources to expand into many other media besides shortwave. It had to train video journalists and recruit internet program managers and web designers. It had and still must meet the accelerating demands of an information technology revolution, which these days is experiencing what one expert called a generation of change in about 18 months. And yet it still had to reach those shortwave listeners, because in this world today, about half the people have yet to make their first telephone call. All of this required vast new resources. Yet from the end of the Cold War until today, the U.S. government generally has been inclined to cut rather than to expand resources for public diplomacy programs. I suppose I should also say that at the present time, you do have the Board of Governors that is overseeing all of this expansion into multimedia, but the Board of Governors also is creating new radio networks and television networks. Many at the Voice have some doubts about how these new radio stations and television stations are being constructed. They appear to be aimed primarily at entertainment and less at information. Radio Sawa in Arabic, Radio Farda in Persian, Radio Apki Dunya in Urdu to Pakistan, and Radio Ashra in Dari and Pashto to Afghanistan are all new stations, highly produced soundbite approaches to the news with much, much popular music either from the area or the United States. And so questions are beginning to be raised about whether substantively those programs add up to the traditions of the Declaration of Independence and VOA broadcasting generally.
Interesting new challenge, but let me ask you to just wrap it up in a couple of seconds here by giving us your prognosis. Look in your crystal ball. Is the future bright for VOA?
I would say the future for VOA is in some doubt because of this trend of the changing philosophy of international broadcasting. Gone are the days when most presidents and kings in the Middle East and South Asia region relied on the Voice as their true window on the world, because they had traditionally depended on VOA for in-depth news, comprehensive and reasoned analysis of the events of the day. And today, alas, they increasingly tune elsewhere. In the Middle East, VOA is a shadow of what it was 5 years ago in the English language. And the board plans cuts in the VOA English broadcast schedule of our own mother tongue by more than 40% later in this U.S. election year. I guess I should say I fear for the future of the Voice. Advocates of independence, all those years, could scarcely have imagined such an outcome.
Well, not only because this program is transmitted by VOA around the world, but also because of my high regard for the Voice of America. I understand your fears, but I hope they prove to be unfounded. It's a great network.
I certainly hope that they are unfounded as well, because people have relied on that Voice of America as their window on the world, reflecting the views of the United States and reflecting what we're all about in this country and they've done that for many years.
Well, thank you, Alan, for joining us. Good book and great interview. Thank you again.
Thank you very much, Brian. Good to be with you.
I've been speaking with Alan L. Heil, Jr., the author of Voice of America, A History, published by Columbia University Press. And this is Talking History. The current unfortunate state of the country of Haiti has a history in which the United States plays a significant role. Our guest commentator this week, Thomas Fleming, looks at one small but important aspect of that history.
In 1801, a smiling Thomas Jefferson invited Louis-André Pichon, the French chargé d'affaires, for a visit. The new president cheerfully informed him that if France wanted to regain the island of Saint-Domingue, the Americans were eager to cooperate. Then, as now, Saint-Domingue was divided into a French-speaking western third, the future Republic of Haiti, and a Spanish-speaking eastern two-thirds, the future Dominican Republic, with a range of mountains between them. France's 1789 revolution had triggered a civil war that wrecked the island's economy. Out of the turmoil emerged an extraordinary black leader, Toussaint L'Ouverture, who tried to create a biracial society. Nothing would be easier than to supply everything for your army and navy and to starve out Toussaint, Jefferson told Pichon. The president wanted to show his undying enthusiasm for the French Revolution, in spite of the way it had morphed into a military dictatorship under Napoleon Bonaparte. Jefferson also wanted to remove Toussaint, who gave the South's millions of black slaves dangerous dreams of freedom. Before the president knew what was happening, Napoleon had a 15,000-man army heading for Saint-Domingue. Then came disturbing news from Paris. Napoleon had secretly persuaded Spain to cede the immense territory of Louisiana, the heartland of North America, to France. The French army, after occupying Saint-Domingue and disposing of Toussaint, was going to head for New Orleans and assume control of Louisiana. At this point, the cool realism of Secretary of State James Madison took charge of the situation. He persuaded his close friend, President Jefferson, that when the French army arrived in Saint-Domingue, it would not receive an iota of food or a dollar of American money. This decision played no small part in wrecking Napoleon's plans for a new world empire. Another large factor was the fierce resistance of Saint-Domingue's blacks, even after Toussaint was captured and shipped to France to die in an icy dungeon in the Jura Mountains. Also in the game was Aedes aegypti, the female mosquito that carries the yellow fever virus. Thanks to that small, buzzing creature, the French army melted away to a forlorn remnant. A disgusted Napoleon sold Louisiana to the United States to raise money for a new war with England. This diplomatic triumph made Jefferson an icon of the Democratic Party. On Saint-Domingue, a new black leader emerged, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, who slaughtered every white person still alive on the French section of the island. The news sent a shudder of fear through the American South. In 1804, after Jefferson's landslide re-election for a new term, the president's son-in-law, Congressman John W. Epps of Virginia, rose to declare that U.S. merchants should have nothing to do with a race Americans needed to depress and keep down. Congress passed a law prohibiting all trade with Haiti. President Jefferson, the not-so-secret sponsor of the measure, quickly signed it. This guaranteed Haiti's isolation for most of the 19th century, during which it became the poverty-ridden, coup-tormented mess it remains today.
You've been listening to historian Thomas Fleming, whose latest book is The Illusion of Victory, America in World War I. Fleming's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Network. And finally, we complete our reading of the unpublished Civil War diary of J.C. Wilmarth, Union soldier from Massachusetts. Last week, released from Andersonville Prison, Wilmarth was moved from prison to prison until he arrived in Charleston, South Carolina. This week, he finally gets to go home. December 18, 1864. On board steamer Star of the West, expect to sail north soon. Get plenty to eat now, pork, crackers, onions, and coffee. Ate too much yesterday and feeling pretty poorly today. Shall be more careful hence until I get some of my strength, which is required to digest raw onions and salt pork. I feel that life is doubly precious now since I've lived through so much hardships and misery. I'm in the cabin on the floor with warm clothes, blanket, and everything to make me precious comfortable. And when I get to Annapolis and can write to my dear friends and also hear from them how happy I shall be. The privilege of corresponding is a great pleasure to the soldier and doubly so to me, as 7 months have passed since I heard a word from friends at home. December 23rd, Mr. Ensign Kelly of Attleboro, assistant state agent, came to see me today. Got a pass for me and took me downtown. Went into the State House, or rather Capitol Building. Had a good dinner. Saw Colonel Mulford, Commissioner of Exchange of Prisoners. He questioned me considerable concerning prison usages. Wrote a letter to my wife. I'm feeling gay, as I am soon to get a furlough and $50 ration money and 2 months' pay. December 25th. Started from Baltimore this morning at 9. Arrived at New York City a little after dark. At 8 o'clock, took the cars for Boston. December 26th. Arrived in Boston at 7 this morning, and you cannot tell how glad to be in my native state once more. Welcomed by friends and kindred, after months of suffering that I have tried to make plain but failed here, sadly, for pen cannot describe the suffering we have passed through. Many may think these are exaggerated reports and sketches, but they are true as far as they go. But not 1/50th part of the trials and hardships and cruelty of the rebels are down on these few pages. I'm not capable of giving the idea that I wish I might, nor do I think anyone can definitely enough that persons may know the exact amount of sufferings in the cruel prisons at the South during the war. But thanks to God for my deliverance from almost death, I am yours respectfully, John C. Wilmarth. And that's it for another week of Talking History. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, Fiona Beatty, producer. Our radio engineer is Alex Smith. For more information on Talking History or the OEH, visit our website at oeh.org. A Moment in Time is produced by Dan Roberts and distributed by WCBE-FM in Richmond, Virginia. Their website is amomentintime.com. And special thanks to John Metters, who called the Wilmarth Diary to my attention and gave us permission to use it on our show. Until next time, this is your host, Brian.